One of the reasons people are so quick to be influenced by social influencers is because it gives them a sense of belonging. We in the church need to be really, really good in the church community at connecting with other people. Now, we can't force it, but we need to have the opportunities there.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Relate, Refresh, and Restore, a podcast committed to bringing stories of hope and insight to those on the front lines of Christian ministry. Our desire is for all of us to see, sense, and experience God's voice through their stories. And through these stories, we may see His hand and hear His voice in our lives. The Relate, Refresh, and Restore podcast is brought to you by Romans 12 Ministries, where we are wildly committed to transforming the church, one pastor, missionary, and ministry leader at a time.
What comes to mind when I say mental illness? I'm not sure about you, but for me, I think of those extreme cases that I've witnessed. I remember in high school, my girlfriend at the time worked at an assisted living center, and I walked into the lobby to pick her up, and there was a resident with a walker who continually walked and banged himself into the wall, mumbling to himself, and I thought, oh my word. And just recently, we just got back from San Diego, and there was a homeless man in a wheelchair, sitting in front of a Starbucks, screaming at the top of his lungs obscenities and words that you could not decipher. And he was doing that and twitching the whole time. And what amazed me about that is that the regular customers just kind of walked by him and got their drink and walked out like this was an everyday occurrence. So that's what I think of when I think of mental illness. But our guest today, Dr. Todd Linneman, who is the president of Relational Advantage and a clinical psychologist, shares with us the true definition of mental illness, some of the latest research, and hope for pastors, for ministry leaders, for all of us in churches to help those that are struggling with mental illness. You know, I'm not sure how you feel about stats, but it is overwhelming when you think about some of the statistics when it comes to mental illness. And one of them was 23% of pastors surveyed indicated that they had battled a mental illness of some kind on a personal level. And that the majority of pastors who were surveyed stated that they would want to help people with mental illness and believe that the church should be a resource. And that has changed over the years. It goes on. I mean, we're talking 1 in 5 people struggle with some sort of mental illness in a given year. That's about 44 million people, and an estimated 18 to 20 million people in the United States are diagnosed for the first time each year with either an anxiety or depressive disorder. Nearly 50% of all people will experience mental illness sometime in their lifetime, and it goes on and on. And so it's a topic that we need to talk about. And so I so appreciate Dr. Todd Linneman coming in and just sharing really hope that we have and coming alongside people and even ourselves in ways to possibly overcome some of these. My name is David Towne, the host of the Relate, Refresh, and Restore podcast. Well, Dr. Todd Linneman, thank you so much for coming in today.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, we're going to talk about, somewhat of a heavy topic today. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a topic that is rearing its ugly head, and we need some tools to maybe help, not only as pastors and churches, but just as people and mm-hmm. families. And so thank you for coming in and talking about this topic of mental illness. And I would like to just start off with just definition. When you think about mental illness, I shared with you before, I mean, when people talk about mental illness, I think of Robin Williams and Patch Adams,
yes,
and which was a classic, and the mental hospital and those people that are messed up, or the people on the street that, you know, have a blanket on and it's 100 degrees out, or talking to themselves on the corner. But I want to hear your definition because it's broader than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, mental illness is very prevalent. In fact, over 50% or about 50% of the American population at some time in their life is going to be diagnosed or experience symptoms that meet the criteria for mental illness. And when we talk about mental illness, we're talking about different layers or levels, I should say, of severity. It can go from mild, moderate, severe, and extreme. And so when you talk about Patch Adams and his work in the psychiatric hospital, those are seriously mentally ill individuals. And what that basically means is that the challenges they have behaviorally, emotionally, psychologically impair their ability to function in one or more areas of life in a severe fashion. They can't work, they can't carry on, you know, or sustain interpersonal relationships. And so they just don't have the capacity, the resources to function. But there are literally millions of people who are not severely or seriously mentally ill, but they are still experiencing the challenges of mental illness nevertheless. It's just not as severe. So think of depression, major depressive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, bipolar disorder, bipolar 1 and 2, schizophrenia. Substance abuse is a mental illness. So there's a long list. I think there's 132 types of mental illness, at least. And so there's a broad spectrum. And literally millions of people are struggling every day with a form of mental illness. Now, fortunately, their ability to function isn't greatly or significantly impaired. Sometimes it is, to the point of having suicidal thoughts. But over 25 million people a year are diagnosed for the first time with an anxiety disorder. About 18 to 20 million people are diagnosed for the first time with a depressive disorder or a mood disorder. So it's very prevalent, but fortunately, it's not always so severe that it requires hospitalization. Mm. But it can be just as challenging and destructive interpersonally, spiritually, emotionally, and psychologically.
So pastors, I mean, they're perfect, right? So they don't have to deal with any of this.
Pastors are immune from mental illness, yes. Oh, they would love that to be true.
Yeah, well, we have found in our work that that is what you're just describing, and those percentages is very real with those pastors and ministry leaders and missionaries. Mm-hmm. So what have you seen in that when it comes to church leadership and these mental disorders?
Yes. Well, you know, pastors are human, and so they fall into the same categories as all the rest of us humans in that they are just as vulnerable, just as susceptible as experiencing an anxiety disorder, depression, or other types of mental illness. So there's no immunity there. They get no pass. But they've also got a very unique set of stressors in their life, especially if they're in that leadership position, that senior pastor position. But anytime you're in the helping profession, it is going to increase your chances of experiencing compassion fatigue. We're now calling it secondary post-traumatic stress. And so people who help people have to be really, really careful. It's not difficult to take on the burdens of others like we're commanded to in Scripture, but sometimes we can go beyond what is in our best interest or other people's best interest in taking too much responsibility. Pastors, because they often have big hearts and they're generous and compassionate, they can easily fall prey. So I work with pastors quite often who have compassion fatigue. And then they also have the cultural dynamics that are going on. Not as many people going to church, not as many people believing in God. They've got the financial responsibilities of keeping the church going. So those stressors can definitely create greater vulnerability when it comes to experiencing these symptoms.
You know, I was reading something recently about the different hats that pastors wear. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's actually a book on this. Here's the list. A speaker's hat, which is what we think about pastors, right?
Right.
I used to always think, okay, a pastor, all they do is they just speak and that's it. They do their sermon. But they have a speaker's hat, a captain's hat, the coach's hat, the executive hat, the director's hat, visionary, the counselor's hat,
yes,
which is what we're talking about, the student's hat, the pioneer's hat, the conductor's hat.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a lot of hats to wear and a lot of things to juggle.
It is.
And in the area of counseling, I mean, I think we have seen, I guess my question is there a trend upward in these percentages when it comes to mental illness? And does a pastor and a ministry leader need to kind of know how to handle some of the things that are coming at them when it comes to a mental health of a person?
Well, I think pastors would serve themselves well by being well informed when it comes to knowing the reasons why they might be more vulnerable to experiencing burnout or symptoms of depression and anxiety. Pastors need to be informed. They need to know how to set appropriate boundaries, when it's okay to extend assistance, when it's not. And so too many pastors aren't informed. They often struggle with that notion that, you know, I've got to be all things to all people. And so they don't do real well with limits. And so their resiliency isn't as great, and they can fall prey. In fact, 23% of all pastors surveyed by one organization said that they have personally struggled with mental illness, typically depression, anxiety, burnout, and so on. So yes, they need to be aware. They're not invincible, and they need to put safeguards in place, because if the person wearing all those hats is compromised, guess what? The whole flock, the whole congregation, the staff they lead could be compromised. So yes, they got to be very careful in that regard.
What about just a ministry leader, a pastor, being vulnerable with their flock? Would you say that that's a healthy thing? Or I just remember in the olden days, you know, you got to keep that close to your vest. You've got to pretend that there's nothing going on, and you need to just show confidence. And what would you say to that?
Well, pastors already tend to be put on a pedestal, and it can really do more harm when they fall off that pedestal. And so I think the more transparent they can be with their congregation in a reasonable fashion, the better, because they're more relatable that way. People are going to have more reasonable expectations for them. And they're also going to say, we're all in the same boat, folks. We're all, you know, susceptible to these stressors in life. I'm no different than you. And I think that when they're, you know, that transparent, that vulnerable, it creates greater intimacy. And I think it also normalizes the experience. So when pastors speak from the pulpit, not only about, you know, the reality of stress and mental illness specifically, if they can share their own struggle, it's going to be far more impactful for the congregation. Oh, the pastor can admit it, so can I. Maybe if the pastor went for help, maybe I can go and get help. Do you know that the community at large, the population at large, outside the church, is twice as likely to ask for help or seek counseling than people who attend church? And it's somewhat remarkable.
Now, why is that?
Well, I think there's still a stigma within the church. It's improved tremendously. I remember back in the 80s when I first started practicing, it was difficult to get support from pastors in encouraging their parishioners to go to counseling. And they often were skeptical about medication and so on. So I think we've learned a lot and come a long way. But the church is still behind, you know, the general population, the public at large, when it comes to understanding mental illness is a real thing. It requires intervention oftentimes, not always, but often, and some form of treatment in order to keep it from escalating and becoming more severe. So I think by, again, pastors talking about it, it gives permission, you know, for their parishioners to seek help, and not just from within the church, which is a great thing, of course, but outside the church walls as well. It's kind of like, you know, you've got a heart problem, so you go talk to your pastor about the heart problem, and if the pastor doesn't say, you know what, I love you, brother, and I'd love to help you, I'll walk with you, and maybe that will help your heart, but you need to see a cardiologist. Mm-hmm. And it's really no different, because mental illness is a medical problem. Not unlike lung disease, heart disease, diabetes. And so I think as the church understands that, and more people in the church are, the less fearful we will be to seek effective treatment.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've been thinking a lot lately of the early church and what was like it. I was talking to Brother V. He was a guest on our, and he works in India, and there is just an explosion going on in India when it comes to, it's almost like the early church in Acts. And I read this recently, and I want to talk to you. I'm going to read it real quick. It's in Acts 2, and it says, the early church, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles. All the believers were together, and they had everything in common. Selling their possessions and goods, they gave to anyone as he asked and needed. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes, and they ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Mm-hmm. I just love that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were committed to prayer and all this, but they were being persecuted at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was happening in India and mm-hmm. in many parts of our country.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wonder, in the United States, that's not happening to us. And I'm just wondering if this mental illness, what the causes are, you know, and is there mental illness going on in the early church, or do we just cover that up? Or, what's the cause? I mean, what's happening?
Well, mental illness has been around as long as sin has been around. And so it is a phenomenon that, every generation has known. We call it different things. We respond to it differently, of course. But, you know, if I may say this, as you read that passage, what really stood out to me were several things. Prayer, of course, but fellowship and giving to one another. What I find can create a real vulnerability for mental illness, depression, anxiety, is social isolation. And as a society, we are becoming more and more isolated because of social media, technology, the busyness of life, and the list goes on and on. And many times when I work with pastors or people in the church who are depressed and anxious, they don't have a good friend group. They don't have connections on a consistent basis. They are isolated. And that's one of the reasons I'm convinced in Scripture it says, don't forsake, you know, the coming together of believers, because that fellowship is so important. In fact, belonging, significance, knowing that we have value that's intrinsic is fundamental to the human condition. And one of the reasons people are so quick to be influenced by social influencers is because it gives them a sense of belonging, connection, identity. And we in the church need to be really, really good in the church community at connecting with other people. Now, we can't force it, but we need to have the opportunities there. Because when there is connection and community, there is that sense of belonging, and that increases resiliency on top of what God can do through prayer and through giving to others. So that's absolutely key. And that was very characteristic of the early church, and no doubt what's going on in India today.
And do you think that the lack of connection now is, besides social media, why are we more isolated now?
Well, again, I think technology allows us to not have to be as dependent on, getting out of the house and going to talk to somebody. You know, we've become consumers of information due to technology, and consequently, we just like to take in and take in and take in. But that's one of the reasons. I think another reason, coming off of a pandemic, forced us into isolation. And, you know, you do something long enough, guess what? It becomes a habit. And I'm still working today with people who say, my pandemic lifestyle hasn't changed. It's stuck. I'm still not going to church. I'm still apprehensive about meeting with people, or I just got out of the habit. So I think that's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. And there's just, we can order food brought to our doorstep. You know, we can order things from Amazon, for example, and have it that same afternoon. So we don't have to participate in community anymore in order to take care of the fundamentals of life. So there's a lot of different reasons, but those are some big ones.
You know, it's interesting. I'm working with five young men in their 20s right now, early mm-hmm. 30s, who, because of the pandemic, now they work from home.
Mm.
And they're in the tech and that kind of thing.
Sure.
So they're in their room, and these are very smart young men and doing very well when it comes to professional. Mm-hmm. But they are in their room on the computer. They don't leave, and they're miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And my simple solution to them is that you got to set the alarm, you got to go out for a walk, you got to walk around the lake, you got to do something to get out
mm-hmm.
and to get out with other people,
yes.
whether it's a lunch or a breakfast or something. But do you see that changing?
I think for many people, it may come about as a result of, you know, necessity. They've got to do it because they're feeling very, very desperate. I work with people frequently who are in a similar situation where they work from home. And one of the things I encourage them and challenge them to do weekly is to purposely, intentionally get out beyond their four walls. So hopefully it won't change as a result of desperation, but that's going to be true for many people. I think as time goes on and we get further away from the pandemic, you know, we're going to find a new homeostasis somewhere between the way it used to be and the way it became because of the pandemic. But I think it's important for people to be aware that they are in a dangerous position, possibly. You know, the Dead Sea is called the Dead Sea for a reason. There's no fresh water flowing into it or out of it, okay? It's not a complete loop where it's coming in and going out properly. And as humans, we need to have that loop where we have tributaries flowing into us so that out of our fullness, we can give. So what's happening is that people are drying up and due to that isolation and lack of human connection. And consequently, they're experiencing these symptoms of mental illness. So if we make people aware that, hey, there's a reason for you to get out of your house, to take a walk, to engage in physical activity, and to eat right and things like that. Do you know, David, that good health in general and mental health specifically, 80% is comprised of three variables: sleep, nutrition, and physical activity. If someone engages in those three activities on a consistent basis or looks at those domains and addresses them in a healthy way, that's 80% of making sure they're okay. And another huge variable is social interaction. And so, yes, I hope that that awareness becomes more, you know, that people become more informed and therefore are aware so that they can do something about it.
So when you share that with people, what's the response?
Well, they're surprised, first of all, because they are, you know, often unaware of how important, you know, sleep and nutrition and physical activity is. And for some who aren't, you know, moderately to severely depressed, it motivates them. They say, you know what, I need to change my lifestyle. I need to really look at those behavioral things I can do to feel better and to function at a higher level. Now, if you're talking to somebody who's moderately to severely or extremely depressed, it's kind of like, hey, I hear you, brother, but I have no motivation to even get out of this chair. And that's just the reality of the insidious nature of depression, for example, and mental illness in general. So I think it you know, is good information to have. And if they have enough resources to rely upon, it can really propel them forward. Yeah. Other times, you know, it just gives them more information to think about so that when they do begin feeling better, they might be able to apply it.
Mm. Well, I'm going to hide my Skittles right now from you. We haven't talked about medication. Are we over-medicating for these mental illnesses?
You know, as a clinical psychologist, I'm asked about medication every day. And my opinion is that we are way over-medicated as a society. I have patients that are much more willing to go see a nurse practitioner or their primary care physician to talk about medication than they are to go see a counselor. Now, the opposite is true for many too. Some people say, you know, I don't want to touch medication with a 10-foot pole. The fact is we need to have, you know, people informed well so that they can make that informed decision. The vast majority of people, if they are mildly to moderately, say, depressed or anxious, there are a lot of things that can be done with counseling and behavioral strategies that will help them to, you know, heal. But then there are those who need to have the assistance of medication. We don't even know exactly how the medication impacts, you know, depression and anxiety and so on. We just know it does. We have theories. But the reality is that I know that I've worked with people over the years who are alive today because of medication. We've got to find the balance. Mm-hmm. And we need to be careful when it comes to making those decisions of how we're going to be treated. It's no different than somebody who has a lifestyle that creates obesity, for example, but rather than changing the lifestyle, they want to take a diet pill. And that's temporary at best.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, Dr. Lindemann, you know, this podcast is really for stories of hope. And this was a heavy topic, but a reality and real in what people are dealing with. I'd like to end with stories of hope, of a hopeful way, because we have, as I worked with education, we got young people that are so stressed out. Anxiety is up crazy. We have marriages. We have all these different things. There's depression and all the things that you've talked about. What suggestions would you have for these dear, dear people, these leaders that are dealing with these different types of mental illness?
Yeah. Well, number one, I would say don't go it alone. Be transparent. Share your troubles. Allow other people to help carry your burdens. And sometimes it's very wise to have professionals help you out, whether it's a counselor, a psychologist, you know, a prescriber like a nurse practitioner or a psychiatrist. So don't go it alone. You're not going to get the help. You're not going to experience the healing fast enough. It's great to have faith by all means. It's great to pray. God is a healer. He is the healer. So we want to definitely utilize our faith in that capacity, but we need to reach out and get help. And there are a lot of qualified people to do that. I would also say that there's not a day goes by that I don't have somebody in my office in tears, usually desperately looking for hope. And one of the things I tell them is, you know what, after 25, 30 years, I wouldn't still be working as a psychologist if there wasn't hope. And I am thrilled to be able to say I have worked with literally hundreds and hundreds of parents, of people who had thoughts of killing themselves, who were so anxious they couldn't leave their home. And I've been blessed with the opportunity to see them on the other side. I tell parents practically every week, couples, I'm working with a woman right now who's grieving the loss of her husband recently. And she just asked me this common question, am I ever going to get better? And with all confidence in the world, I can say, yes, you are likely to get better. I can't give you 100% guarantee because I don't have that knowledge, but I've worked with many, many people who have come back to say, you were right. So persevere, seek help, continue to follow through with recommendations, take it a day at a time, and recognize that the greatest growth in life typically occurs during times of adversity. I tell people that we want to live in our comfort zone, but if we want to grow, we have to go to the grown zone. And sometimes we fight it and we resist it, but if we can just take a practical approach to dealing with it, accept it, oftentimes that's when we go to a higher level of functioning. And that's oftentimes the benefit of it. So that's what I would say to give people encouragement and hope.
And community, and nutrition.
Absolutely.
And exercise, and getting outside, and the sunshine.
That's right.
Those are all great things.
Yes.
Wow. Dr. Lindemann, you're such a blessing.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing with us and for giving us that hope.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, David.
How can people get a hold of you?
They can go to my website, which is relationaladvantage.com. Information on how to contact me is right there.
Thanks for what you're doing for our community.
You bet.
Thank you for joining us today at another episode of Relate, Refresh, and Restore, a podcast sponsored by Romans 12 Ministries. For more information on Romans 12 Ministries, visit us at romans12ministries.org or give us a call at 520-982-5877. May we all continue to be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, and faithful in prayer.